You know, so often we talk about freedom. What is freedom? What does it mean to be free? And yet I want to make a rather startling proposition that inseparably tied to freedom, true freedom, moral freedom, is the concept of law, particularly God's law. Come on in and to the program, join me, and you'll see what I mean.
The fact is, I have very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason cannot teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the more unlikely becomes the whole scenario and theory they use to explain the origins of life. The amazing thing that quantum physics shows is that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and belief in ways that biblical faith never does.
I want to start with a quote from a well-known book called The Great Controversy. Listen to this quote. From the very beginning of the great controversy in heaven, it has been Satan's purpose to overthrow the law of God. It was to accomplish this that he entered upon his rebellion against the Creator. And though he was cast out of heaven, he has continued the same warfare upon the earth. Thus, to deceive men, and thus lead them to transgress God's law, is the object which he has steadfastly pursued. Whether this be accomplished by casting aside the law altogether or by rejecting one of its precepts, the results will ultimately be the same. He that offends in one point manifests contempt for the whole law. His influence is on the side of, his influence and example are on the side of transgressors, of transgression. He becomes guilty of all. That's The Great Controversy, page 582. Now, I've always been fascinated by that first line. From the beginning of the great controversy in heaven, it has been Satan's purpose to overthrow the law of God. Overthrow the law of God? Why? What's the purpose in that? What's the point? How do we understand what is being said here? And that's what I want to look at. Let's think about this for a minute. I want you to imagine a hypothetical. Let's, for starters, imagine that there were no God, that the universe were what a lot of scientists tell us it is, a godless place, just a system, as one astronomer called it. A famous cosmologist once said that the universe, quote, is just one of those things that happen from time to time. Isn't that a brilliant explanation? The universe is just one of those things that happen from time to time. But the point is, there is no God. Let's take that assumption. Now, let's take this a step further. And let's assume something else about the universe that we all know is false. And that is not only is that there's no God, but there's no life as well. So we know that's false because we're here and we're alive. So you've got a totally lifeless, a totally godless, a totally consciousless creation. And I'm emphasizing that word, consciousness. There's nothing conscious in the universe, just a dead universe, no life at all. In such a universe where no God existed and no life did either, the universe would be, and listen to this word, the universe would be amoral. Now think about this a minute. Amoral, not immoral, as in bad morals, but amoral, as in no morals at all, because nothing in it, such as lifeless rocks hurling through a godless cosmos, could manifest moral qualities. See, we need to understand the difference between amoral and immoral. Lifeless rocks hurling through a lifeless cosmos are amoral. They're not good, they're not bad, they're not right, they're not wrong. They're none of that. In such a context, a godless, lifeless, consciouslessness universe, the very idea of morality of any kind, good or bad, makes no sense at all. Amoral, that's an amoral universe. Immoral means morality exists, but it's a bad morality. It's bad morals, corrupt morals, and so forth. You couldn't have immorality in the kind of universe we've been talking about because nothing in it could act immoral, okay? However, as we know, if we believe God exists, we know humans do as well, and we have all been and we have been created as moral beings. We are moral creatures as humans, and central to that morality is our capacity to give and receive love. We were created as beings who could love. We created as beings who could love, who could give it, and who could receive it. Adam and Eve, when first created, certainly loved each other and certainly loved God and certainly loved their children. I mean, love was a factor from the start. I mean, was it not? I mean, in the beginning, there was love. You almost say in the beginning, there was God. In the beginning, there was love. Now, here's a crucial point. For this love to exist, however, freedom, moral freedom, has to exist too. Because love is a moral concept that couldn't arise in an amoral universe, such as one composed of only rocks and space. You couldn't have love in that kind of creation, could you? Of course not. There's nothing there. There's just rocks and space. There's no such thing as love. But here's a crucial point that you've got to remember, though. Love, to be love, has to be freely given. I think I said this here before. God can force all the universe to fear him. He can. I mean, God could be pretty fearsome if he wanted. He could force all the universe to worship him. He could force everything in the universe to obey him. He can do all that. But God, the one thing God can't, well, I say not one thing, but one thing he cannot do is he cannot force one creature to love him. Understand, love to be love has to be freely given or it's not love at all. You understand that? Love to be love has to be freely given or it's not love. God cannot force love. So what are the implications of this? For us to be able to love God, we had to be created as morally free. Morally free beings who could choose out of their moral freedom to love him or not to love him. The key here again is freedom. To love or even to do anything moral, we have to have the freedom to not do it if we chose not to, or else it's not a moral act. I mean, if you were forced to do the right thing, no one would really call your choice a moral choice, would they? If you're forced to do it. Think about this for a minute. Someone could program a computer to filter out X-rated websites so that children wouldn't go there. Okay? Blocked out X-rated websites, block out pornography. Now, the computer was performing something moral, was it not? It was doing something moral. And yet, who would say that the computer itself was moral? Of course not. The computer wasn't moral. The computer, it might have been performing a moral function, but that doesn't make it, the computer itself, moral. Let's try another example. You're in terrible pain. Terrible, terrible pain. And it's ruining your life. It's making your life miserable. So you take a painkiller, okay? You take a painkiller and the pain goes away and you feel so much better. Your life is so much better now. You have such a better life. Is the drug moral? Does the drug have moral capacities? Of course not. The whole idea is ludicrous. It's funny, in Judaism, the highest mitzvah, the highest good deed is to save a life. Okay? It's reasonable. Well, suppose someone was about to murder you. Suppose someone was about to murder you, was in your house, ready to shoot you, or stab you or whatever, when accidentally a beam in the roof, which has been weak for months, falls and lands on the would-be murderer's head, knocking him out and saving your life, okay? I suppose it's not absurd that something like that could happen. So let me ask you a simple question. Was the plank moral? I mean, did the plank just perform a mitzvah? Was there something noble in the plank itself so what it did would be deemed moral? Of course not. The idea is ludicrous. Why? Why is it ludicrous? It boils down to a simple fact. It boils down to one simple thing. For morality to exist, for something to be moral, for a being to be moral, for a person to be moral, for an act to be moral, it implies the ability to choose. It means the ability to pick between right or wrong, good and evil. It means the freedom exists to choose, in the case of God, to choose to love or to choose not to love, to choose right or to choose wrong. That issue of choice has to exist, and for there to be true choice, real choice, there has to be real freedom. Now, where am I going with this? For the universe to be a moral universe, in the sense that that morality can exist in it, for the universe to be moral, to allow the potential for good or evil, for right or wrong, it would have to have something to define good and evil, right and wrong, right? In other words, if for there to be good and evil, right and wrong, something has to define it for it to exist. And what would that thing be to define it other than God's law or a moral law? In other words, it's very simple. For the universe to be moral, it would have to have a law to define that morality. In other words, how do you know? How do you know what is right, what is wrong, what is good, what is evil? You have to have a law, just like we've got here on Earth, telling you what the speed limit is, what you can do, what you cannot do. We need something to define it. And if we're in a moral universe where there's right and wrong, good and evil, we need something to define what those are for us. And according to the Word of God, that thing that defines morality is what we call the moral law, Ten Commandments. Let me read you some words from Paul. This is Romans 7:7. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. Indeed, I would have not known sin except through the law. For I would have not known what coveting really was if the law had not said, do not covet. Simple enough. Let me ask you a question. Is it sinful? Is it sinful to have red hair? Is it? Why not? Because God's law doesn't forbid red hair. If it did, as his law forbids covetousness, then red hair would be a sin. Simple as that. But it cannot be a sin if no moral law defines it as such. See, my point is simple. Yet I think it's a point worth mulling over. Morality without law is as impossible as is thought without mind. Think about that again. I'm going to say it again. Morality without law is as impossible as thought is without mind. You see, our universe is moral because God created free beings answerable to his law. If there was no law against coveting, there would be no sin of covetousness. If there were no law against red hair, there would be no sin of redheadedness, no matter how many redheaded coveters populated the cosmos. You see, Paul here was talking about the moral law in the context of humanity, which is the Ten Commandments. Now, I have no idea the exact form of the law as exists in heaven or other parts of the cosmos. I mean, I'm not sure, but I doubt it probably has something like, you shall not covet your neighbor's donkey. Though, I guess, I don't know, maybe they have donkeys on other parts of the universe. I don't know. The point is, morality, though, means a delineation of what is right and what is wrong. Again, in a godless, lifeless cosmos consisting only of dead rocks, this is all meaningless. It's meaningless. But in a universe where morality exists, where right and wrong and good and evil exists, where free beings can choose, and free beings can choose between them, between right and wrong, there has to be a law. There has to be a law that defines what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is evil, so that these free moral beings can choose between them. Otherwise, they're not really free and they're not really moral. Here's Paul again using metaphorical language, bringing out the same idea. This is Romans 7, 9 through 12. Listen to what he says. Once I was alive apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin sprang to life and I died. I found that the very commandment that was intended to bring life actually brought death. For sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment, deceived me, and through the commandment put me to death. Therefore, the law is holy, and the commandment holy and just and good. Though the context is that of salvation by faith through Jesus, apart from the works of the law, that's the issue here. That's the whole point here. His point, though, the crucial point, that comes out of this, which we looked at earlier, is that the law reveals sin. The law shows us what is right, what is wrong, what is good, what is evil, what we should do, what we shouldn't do. See, one of the great questions that people have asked is, how do we know what to do? How do we know what is right, what is wrong? There's a whole branch of philosophy, ethics, that deals with these questions because they're not always so simple, especially if you don't have something transcendent above it. Anyway, the point is that's why Paul says the law is holy, is the commandment holy and just and good. And it's good and just and holy because a holy, just and good God created it. And as we know, and we like to say, the law reflects the character of God. In other words, that's not, people sometimes have trouble with that concept, but it shouldn't be a hard concept. The laws of a nation reflect the character of a nation. The laws of a fascist dictatorship reflect the laws of a fascist dictatorship, reflect the morals, the character of a fascist dictatorship. The law of a free, liberal, democratic regime reflect the character of them there. But the point is, photons, palm trees, commas, computers, and rocks hurling through dead space don't need moral laws because they are not moral entities. Humans are. We are moral entities. And what defines our morality is God's law, what we often call the Ten Commandments. Now, let's just review our logic here. Let's go back over what we've just looked at here because this gets to the point. God created humans as creatures who can love, okay? We all know we can love. Love, though, can exist without freedom, particularly, especially moral freedom, okay? You can't love if you're not free and moral, you know, and we need true moral freedom because love is a moral concept. And moral freedom can't exist without law, moral law. Thus, love rests on freedom, and freedom Interestingly enough, as I said in the beginning, freedom rests on law. Hence, the core of God's government, the foundation of that government, a government of love, has to be God's law. See the point? It all, love, freedom, law, they're all inseparable. A government of love, a God of love. God with freedom ultimately requires a moral law. Okay. Now, that's why Ellen White wrote what she did about Satan's desire to overthrow the law of God. See, the attack on the law is not an attack just on God's character, but on the creation itself. Think about this. Why does Satan want to overthrow the law of God? Because it's the foundation upon which the broad and universal realities of freedom and love rest. Two crucial elements in how God has revealed himself and his true character to the universe. I mean, what kind of God would he be if we weren't created free and we weren't capable of love? Freedom and the love that stems from it reveals reams about the God who gave these gifts to us. Thus, if Satan then were to go after this God at the deepest depths, if he wanted to undermine God and his government in the broadest way possible, it would have to be at God's law himself. Now remember, too, what she said about the overthrowing of God's law being accomplished by two ways, simply by, and one of those ways was by rejecting one of its precepts. Now what does that mean? Well, imagine you want to take the naturalization in order to become an American citizen. You got to take the oath. And the oath reads, and let me repeat it, I hereby declare on oath, I absolutely, entirely renounce and abjure all allegiance and fidelity to any foreign prince, potentate, state, or sovereignty of whom I have therefore been subject or citizen, that I will support and defend the Constitution and the laws of the United States against all enemies, foreign or domestic, and on and on and on. Now, suppose, though, you come to the part of the oath that says, I will support and defend the Constitution and the laws of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and you refuse to read it. You say, everything else is fine. Everything else is fine, but I cannot agree to that one section and I will not read it out. I don't accept it. Now, what do you think will happen to your naturalization? I don't know how this all works, but my guess is it would be voided. You would not be naturalized. I mean, what would it look like that, you know, what would happen if everyone who took the oath said the same thing? If everyone the oath decided, well, I'm going to accept this part of the oath, I'm going to accept that, but I'm going to reject this and I'm going to reject that. I mean, the whole process would be of no avail unless the readers decided, or the government decided to change the oath. Now, maybe the U.S. government could do that to the oath, but God isn't going to do that to his holy law. Thus, in parallel, Satan wars against God's law by getting humanity to do the same thing, to reject one of its precepts, which we know is the fourth commandment. But even that's not arbitrary. Satan has succeeded almost to get the whole world to reject the one commandment that goes to the heart of God as God. To usurp the seventh-day Sabbath is to usurp the Lord's authority at the most prime level possible, that of him as creator, the very thing that makes our God, God. Satan's attack, not just on the whole law, which is deep enough, but on the Sabbath, is an attempt to get behind everything about God's government and to uproot it at the core. Because God is God because he is the creator, and this goes after the one thing above everything else that points to him, to creator. In a sense, it's a seek by overturning God's law, by removing the one commandment that points to him as creator. It's to attempt to put himself in the place of God himself. Thus, we all know the verse, or we have, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Isaiah 14:14. Or we have the other, what no one deceive you by any means.
For the day will not come until the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits in the temple, sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. 2 Thessalonians 2:3-4. So where have we been? Love is a metaphysic of God's creation. But love can't exist without moral freedom. And moral freedom can't exist without something to define what morals are. And that is God's law. And of all the commandments in his law, the one that's at the root of them all, the one commandment which shows why we should keep all others, is the Sabbath, the specific commandment that Satan has worked so hard to overthrow in his warfare against all of God's law. Thus, the centrality of God's law becomes key to the atonement. Only as we understand the importance of the law can we understand the gravity of what the violation means, and why only the death of Christ, the one who was equal or even greater than the law, could end the crisis and restore the rift that is so deep that Scripture says that the whole creation groans and suffers together. That's heavy. I don't think everybody wrestles with what Paul meant by that. And if the whole creation groans because of sin, no wonder we do as well. Only when we understand the gravity of sin and how deep we are fallen can we truly understand, too, the futility of trying to work your way to heaven by keeping the law. Salvation comes through what Jesus has done for us, and certainly not by what we can do, even under the power of the Holy Spirit. Thus, we come back to the quote that I started with, the quote that has fascinated me for years now, from the very beginning of the great controversy in heaven. It has been Satan's purpose to overthrow the law of God. Why? Because the law, as the foundation of God's government, expresses the moral integrity of the cosmos. And to overthrow the law would be to overthrow the moral order of the creation itself. Thus, we are told, for this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. It's very simple. The link between our loving God and keeping his commandments is stronger than we realize. Until we realize that we can love God because we live in a universe where love can exist. And love can exist only because the universe is moral. And that morality is based, at least for us as created beings, as opposed to the love within the Godhead itself. I'm not going to get into that. That can exist only because of the Ten Commandments. Ironically enough, love, morality, and freedom are rooted in God's law, which explains Satan's hatred of it.